Picking up on Wednesday night and going back to it, for those of you that are not here, just briefly, I was discussing the word paradigm and what a paradigm is by definition somewhere here. That's a kind of a big word. Yep. Paradigm is just a way of saying a pattern or model. What is the paradigm that is sort of the government of people or of people's thinking or their lives? And according to Webster, the paradigm consists of the following things. It consists of, first of all, assumptions. An assumption is supposing a thing is true without having proof. So I raise the question, how many assumptions do you function out of? What is it that we call them presuppositions? We are a presuppositional people. We presuppose certain things, and therefore we function in our lives out of that. So you presuppose creation. You can't really prove creation. You can prove creation to a believer, but you can't prove creation to a non-believer because you can't create. Now, procreation should be a kind of a picture of creation that people could see, but the evolutionist does not accept that. And so when we talk about God creating, we have two suppositions there. Assumptions. We assume God and we assume creation. And we do that because we have developed or had developed into us something we call faith. So back in the times of the Reformation, when these fellows were setting down the order of procedure, they in their conflict with Rome, because Rome is saying faith works, they said it's by faith alone, it's by grace alone, through faith alone. But they're saying faith alone. Well, the faith has to come from somewhere, because every single person has faith. I made a point yesterday with a couple of folks out there that everybody has a faith. Everybody has a belief system. Now, most people don't actually function out of a belief system. They're not conscious of one. They don't even know that they believe something or disbelieve something. They just live. They're like these proverbial blobs that are born, grow up, and die, but there's nothing ever going on inside of them where they're thinking of their lives from the prospect of reason. Why am I doing this? Well, in our paradigm that we call Christianity, I asked the question on Wednesday night, what is Christianity? And we had a couple of things offered. What is Christianity? Because Christianity in today's world is basically just a word. So until you have to define what is Christianity, because that's the paradigm, that's the model that we are supposed to function under. So we say, okay, we have some assumptions or presuppositions, and secondly, there are concepts. And concepts are ideas that are formed in the mind by combining basically two ideas. So if you take two things and put them together, you call that a concept. We think of it as conception in childbirth. We call that conception. So there are two elements that come together and produce this child, which grows, of course, in time, and we learn to work with them as children as they grow up in various facets. What are the concepts? Out of your presupposition, since you presuppose God and you presuppose creation, what then do you put into the order of your assumptions and concepts, well, I would think you would have to put in the word law. You say, well, there is God, and God created, and that makes God sovereign, and as sovereign, he alone has the right to determine law. So we say, okay, how do we think in terms of law? Well, on the front of the bulletin this morning, I put a passage from Romans, and it is really a law or legal passage, but it is not presented like the Ten Commandments, of course, which say, thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not. It's presented in a different way, and I think it's suitable to us, especially today, to ponder at least a little bit on this thing that we call the church. The church is an enormous, enormous, enormous institution. We have no clue how many are in it. When we read the book of Revelation, there are two numbers that stand out. The first one is the 144,000, in which we see in Revelation, we see these 12,000 out of each of the 12 tribes who are sealed in their forehead before the judgment comes on the earth, that God's people, which are identified with Israel there, are sealed. But then we have a number which show up at the throne that come out of the Great Tribulation, or come out of not the Great Tribulation, come out of Great Tribulation, which says it's a number that can't be counted. There are so many in this number in heaven that when John looked at it, he said it's an uncountable number. Well, both of those numbers would fit into this thing we call the church. So when Paul writes to the church at Rome, he starts off by saying, I beseech you. Now, this is like a lawyer who is going to stand in front of a jury, and he's going to make a presentation to them, and he begins with a plea for attention. I beseech you. You have got to give me your special attention concerning what I'm going to say, because it is so important. Yesterday, when everybody had left, basically, except Brennan and Amber and the baby, and we were out back and we were talking, and all of a sudden, Brennan got up and walked over to the porch. There were four screws he had forgot to put in. And so he got up and he walked over and he put those four screws in. And he said to, when he came back, he said to Amber, he said, I almost forgot that. It wouldn't have been complete without those four screws. They're on the railing going down. Well, Paul is standing before the people and he's saying, I need your special attention because what I'm going to give you is so important, you cannot miss it. So he says, I beseech you therefore, and this is his argument for beseeching. First of all, it's the mercies of God. Well, what do you and I have to presume upon where God is concerned that is greater than the mercies of God? Because we have no contribution. By our own logic, by our own faith position, we say constantly, we have made no contribution to our salvation. The salvation we possess is a gift of God. It is you are saved by grace through faith, and this is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. So he starts off his argument, his reasoning, by first of all saying, the basis of my argument that I am going to present is the mercies of God. He follows that up with their bodies. So he's talking about their earthly life. He's talking about how you function on a daily basis, that you present your bodies as a living sacrifice. Now, somewhere in God's order of things, in this paradigm that we call Christianity, where we have these assumptions and we have these concepts, we come to a point that we must pose the question, how much of my life should I give over solely to the worship of Jesus Christ, and that worship being presented in the form of my service, as well as my prayer and my evangelism and things, but in the form of my service. What is it that God has gifted me to do? In my second book that I'm writing, I'm down to the point where I got down to the ear, and then I got to thinking about going beyond that, and it came into my mind about the gift of touch, the ordinary miracle of touch. And I thought about Helen Keller. So I went and I looked at this thing and I said, now wait a minute, here's a girl who was born deaf and blind. She can't hear anything, she can't see anything. And they get this teacher, Ann Sullivan, who comes in and somehow Ann Sullivan can communicate to Helen and teach Helen to communicate so that later on in life, Helen can speak. She still can't hear and she still can't see, but she can speak. And she can advocate. She can give her life in service to try to make things better for deaf people and blind people. People that would consider, now they call them hearing impaired and so forth. Here is this miracle that this woman, Ann Sullivan, performed, God through her. And I'm asking myself the question, how many teachers would there be that you could discover who could actually teach a person like Helen Keller to be able to grow and achieve the things that she achieved? I mean, if you're going to teach her to read Braille, how are you going to teach her, first of all, that those little dots on the page represent letters, because she has to know that? So this is a miraculous thing, and I'm saying, here's what Ann Sullivan did. Ann Sullivan gave her life, basically, to Helen Keller. So the question comes back, in this presenting of your bodies as a living sacrifice, how much of your life are you going to give over in the time you spend here to the service of God in whatever your calling might be, so that you achieve whatever it is that you're going to achieve? And then he puts two things in the living sacrifice. He then puts two things in here. Holy, well, that's separation. Holy means you're separating from the worldliness to the service of Jesus Christ for the advancement of the kingdom, for the building of people and so forth, and that it's acceptable unto God. Now in 2 Timothy 2:15, he says we are to study, which means be diligent or do everything necessary to show yourself approved unto God. Well, how much of your life then becomes separated from the world because the focus of your life is the separation unto God? And Paul is saying, I beseech you to listen now, because I'm going to teach you something, but I need to set this preface, if it would. I need to build this platform for you to stand upon. And then he says, this living sacrifice, or holy and acceptable sacrifice to God, is your, in the King James it says reasonable service, but in the Greek it says rational worship. The word reasonable is rational. It's thought. It's thinking. All right? And service is worship. So it means that in the act or process of worship, there is an actual mental process going on where you are thinking about Jesus Christ, or you're thinking about the creation of God, or you're thinking something in relation to God. This is your rational worship. When we come to church on Sunday morning and we sing a hymn, all right, the hymn has words. Words are intended to communicate, and they're intended to communicate ideas. So if we sing a hymn and the words come out of our mouth, we are singing them. Are we just singing them to the air? We're going to sing these words that they're going to go out in the air, and they're going to be like bubbles that you blow the bubbles and they go up and they pop, and there is no productivity from them. There should be some form of productivity from the words that we sing. So whatever those might be. So this morning, for example, we're going to start by singing, "Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing." He is the fount. He is the fountain out of, or living water, if you would, out of which flows every blessing. Well, those words are supposed to communicate ideas or concepts that we, in the process of singing, are actually thinking about. So this is rational worship. If you read the confession of sin, as you read through the confession of sin, you are going to read, either you're going to read something you're guilty of, or you're going to read something you're not guilty of. So when you read the confession of sin, you might actually read a confession of sin, and you might not have a sense in your spirit that you are guilty of that which you're confessing. Or you may have just a kind of a slight or mild. Or you might actually think, I am really guilty of it, of this, all right? So rational worship is involves thinking. And in the Reformation or tradition of the Reformation, that's what they were doing. They were trying to cause people to think differently about their religious lives and about their responsibilities to God and about the effectiveness of the work of Jesus Christ. And they're saying to them, look, this stuff that Rome is saying and now the Church of England is saying is completely wrong. And we need you to think about this, because the only way Christ is going to be exalted is if we acknowledge Christ as the only source of our salvation and the work of Jesus Christ. So this is his beginning. He begins by saying, I beseech you, and then through the presentation. And then in the second verse, he continues by saying, be not conformed to this world. The word world there is the word age. Be not conformed to the age you're living in. That's the only age you can conform to. You can't. You could probably, if you wanted to be like the Amish, you could look back in time and say, we want to conform to this age back here because our tradition is such and this is how we show our separation. But you say, what is going on in my age? What is the thinking of the world? What is the thinking of the church? To what do I attribute life's problems? Is it a sin problem or is it not a sin problem? So he says, I want you to think about your rational worship, and I want you to not be conformed to this age, but be transformed. You're going to be what you were. You're going to be totally changed by the renewing of your mind. Now, when we took our first definition of education, we said the first definition of education is to enlighten the understanding. That's the same thing as saying renewing of the mind. When I go back to my assumptions, when I go back to my presuppositions, and I go back to my whatever position I'm holding concerning, is there anything there that has to be put aside and a renewal occur so that I think differently? Now, the church, because as we get down into this, as we get into the church and we see the function of the church, I made a little, if you look at the front of your bulletin, there's a subtlety there that is easy to miss, and it's a simple underline of two letters. I put an underline of the word us. No, is it there or is it? No, it's inside. It's inside on the announcement that they are coming to fellowship with. And I underlined the word us. The church, see, the church, local church, as well as the church, but when the local church has a function, the church is supposed to function. So if people are coming to fellowship with us, they're not coming to fellowship with some of us. They're coming to fellowship with us. Well, that has to take place in the rational worship. That has to take place in the thinking of people who say, I'm a part of the us. Are you a member of the church? Yes, I'm a member of the church. Well, then you're part of the us. Even if you're not a member of the church and you're an attendee in the church, you're a part of the us. They're coming to fellowship with us. So in this renewal, in having the mind retransformed, one of the areas of transformation is right there. Now, who can make that happen? Only one I know is the Lord. Billy answered correctly. God can make that happen. Well, one of the things you'll find out about the little kids in school is that they always figure there's a couple of safe answers. Either God, Jesus, or the Bible. So they can answer those three answers to any question. God, Jesus, or the Bible. Well, that you may prove, this is by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Well, is the fellowship of the church, can that be put into the perfect will of God? Can that be put into what is said? Does God say, God says, well, I'm going to build my church, and then I'm going to build my church so that it is incredibly fragmented. Well, that's not what we're going to see here in Romans. So this is his, all of this is the beginning of his teaching. He is still laying the foundation for the teaching, and he's trying to bring these people to the point where they're actually worshiping rationally or thinking. And there are two things occurring. While they are thinking, they are doing self-examination. Now, listen, I don't think a lot of people ever do self-examination. They just are. They're just these blobs, as I said. They're in life. They're going through life. But they never, ever look at themselves, especially in the light of the Word. So he's going down through this. And now he says, I say through the grace given to me, in verse 3, to every man that is among you. Now that would be to every person that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. He's not just saying here, don't be arrogant. Don't think of yourself as though you are something superior. Because you can think of yourself as being superior without ever consciously acknowledging that you're doing it. If you are not a willing part of the us, you have to be something else. So if you're not willingly a part of the us, that means you are separating yourself. So there is an area of separation. So we say, well, to this point, I'm willing to be a part of the us to this point, but I'm not willing to be a part of the us totally. So if the body in my books, what I'm trying to come, these are the ordinary miracles of God. Hopefully, somebody will actually read them, and the Holy Spirit can minister to them, and they can think about something like seeing or hearing or whatever it might be, and say, you know what, that really is miraculous. My body does function in a very wonderful way. Paul said, or the psalmist said, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Well, when I get down to Helen Keller and I'm saying, now, wait a minute, here is a person who cannot see nor hear. It comes right after my little thing on the ear, on the hearing, and the balance that comes from the ear. I'm saying, what about this miracle we call touch? So with my fingers, I can tell how warm something is, how cold something is. I can do other things with my hand where I'm using the hand. But the touch specifically might not come in. But in the case of Helen Keller, this Ann Sullivan had to take Helen Keller, who was, they always portray her, I've only ever seen one film on Helen Keller, and they portray her as this young girl who is really wild, and I could understand that she would be. How are you going to discipline a child that you can't talk to? And Ann takes her and takes her to the point of communication that she can use her fingers to put them on people's faces and learn something about the person. But she can now take the sense of touch in her fingers and put them on a paper and feel these dots on the paper and know whether they're A, B, C, D. And because she has to spell every word. As she takes her fingers across, she can't do like you. You look at a word and your eyes can see the whole word. She has to, first of all, spell each word. A-N-D, okay, I, will, W-I-L-L. And she's going across and feeling. When we were I can never think of that woman's name, at the homestead in South Dakota, Laura Ingalls Wilder, her sister had gone blind, and she had to learn to read using Braille, and they have in the home there that Charles built for his wife, they have a book that is in Braille. And so the girl that was the hostess there that day, she and I were talking about it, and we had it open, and I was looking at this thing, and I put my hand down on it to see if I could tell any distinction. And I said, "Can you read this?" She said, "You know what?" She said, "I'm trying and I'm trying." She said, "I've got to where I can actually feel some of the letters, and I can shut my eyes and know, but no, I can't read it." So I'm saying, well, how do you take these fingers, the sensitivity of these fingers, and take a person who can neither speak nor hear and teach them that certain dots mean certain letters so that over the process of time, this person can actually read that book? And I say that has to be miraculous. God has to be directly involved in this. Now, that's my presupposition. My assumption is it's God. It's not human nature. It's not because Ann Sullivan in herself was so great, but because God had, by his Holy Spirit, given her the wisdom and ability to take this girl and to do with her what she did, so that Helen, when people speak of Helen Keller, it is easy now to spread over the fact that she was what she was, and we don't really think about the miraculous side of it. So I said, don't think of yourself more highly than you ought. Don't spend too much time thinking about yourself, whether that's in good things or bad things. But think soberly, according as God has dealt to every man the measure of faith. So every person has a measure of faith. The measure of faith you have will fit into the work you do. It'll have some other areas too. Jennifer can take the kids in the school and do musically with them things I cannot do. I can take them and we can do some music, but she can actually take them and prepare them where they're very meager in their abilities to sing to such a degree that when people hear them singing under her direction, they get blessed by their singing. That's because God has gifted her, and she has this ability along with the other abilities she has. She makes pretty neat brownies. I don't know what you do, but you make them, and they're good, all right? So he says now, here he gets down to it in verse 4. We have many members in one body. We only have one body. But we have many members in that body. Now, I got to be honest with you. When the last people to leave here last night was, what, 7:30, 8 o'clock? I was pooped. I was worn out. I was trying to get the yard mowed. I didn't get it all mowed because I had to do it. I had to do it in between. I had to do some here, and then something would be going on, and then I'd do a little bit there, and then I'd try to get other things done. And I was, when the evening, I mean, I was one member of that body of people that was really tired. We have many members, but we only have one body. It's, they're coming to fellowship with us. All right? So this is the thing. There's a van pulled in I don't recognize. Anyway, as we have many members in one body, and all members have not the same office. Now, we're still in the paradigm. We're still into our assumptions and concepts, the things we think that is Christianity. And then he said, we being many are one body, and everyone members one of another. So we're members of each other. We're parts of each other. Okay? That body has to function. I have a place where I deposit food. It has to go from that place to another place where something happens to it and it gets liquefied. It has to go from that place to another place where the body can absorb the nutrients or reject whatever it shouldn't be there. And then I have to have another place in my body to get rid of what the body shouldn't retain, because if it does, I'm going to get sick. So they all have to function together. The body parts function together. That's an essential if you're going to have a well-working body. Having then gifts differing. All right? Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us. Now, he's going to specify some gifts here. But there are some gifts that he doesn't necessarily specify. Having then gifts differing. All right, that's important to understand. Because if we understand that other people have gifts, we can be dependent upon those gifts. Just as they can be dependent on ours, and we have the proper interaction. I went into Mary Yoder's the other day, and Betty was sitting at the computer, and I said to Betty, do you have a pie for Bob? She got this big smile on her face and said, yes, I think I have, and then went in a search. And she ended up having to go into the bakery because she had to track down the pie. There were at least three of us involved in the recovery of that pie. So we were using the gifts, the differing gifts, and this is according to grace. We don't have these because we have really worked so hard to develop them, although we certainly might work hard, but God has to give us the gift in the first place. And now these gifts are used, and so he starts to enumerate gifts here. He says, whether prophecy, which is preaching, let us prophesy, or let us preach according to the proportion of faith. So a preacher who is going to preach has to have the gift that enables him to preach, which means he has to have some intellect. God has to give him the ability to study and to understand what he's studying, so he can now take what he studied and pass that on to the people, who in turn can take it. You see, it isn't when Jim gets up on Sunday morning at 11 o'clock and it comes his turn and he gets up there and he's going through the book of Joshua, he gets up there because there has been what we call a preparation. So the preparation occurs through prayer and study so that he in turn can stand up here and say something that the body of people who are supposed to be recognizing the gift are to be attentive to, so that they can receive whatever the message of that particular time is that God is giving through that preaching. So if you are called to preach, let us preach according to the proportion of faith. So we can't go outside of that, and we can't, you know, we shouldn't diminish it. So there are different levels of preachers who preach different things or teach different things according to the proportion of faith. And then he said, or ministry. Let us wait on our ministering. Well, this morning we had a phone call from Rhonda, who called for prayer, and Martha talked to her for quite a while. And Rhonda is in a state of panic because somebody said to her, you know what? Looking at what's going on, I think you're getting ready to have a heart attack. And so she went deeper into her panic, and so Martha had to minister to her. She had to serve the Lord by trying to communicate what? Reprove, rebuke, exhort. In this case, she was probably giving an exhortation. So he that preaches, wait on his preaching. He that ministers, wait on his ministering. Or he that teaches, on his teaching. It's still on.
No, now you got it back on.
Okay. Anyhow, he that rules with diligence. So that means the governor, and in the Presbyterian form, it is the session in the local church, when in our local church would be Jim and I. And then it's the presbytery, which would be the LaGrange and up north, Painesville and California, Eureka. That would be those churches coming together in governmental fashion, and that is our General Assembly. Presbytery is our General Assembly. So, but anyway, this is governing. And sometimes, if you're going to govern and do it with diligence, sometimes it's not easy, because sometimes you have to do disciplinary measure where you just as soon not. in order to maintain order. And then he that shows mercy with cheerfulness. So people, we need people who are merciful. It is because there are some people who, by the conduct of their life, are in need of mercy. They mess up. Now that tells you that when Christ assembled this church, if he put merciful people in the church who can show mercy, which means they're not coming down on their head all the time, they're trying to find some way to reconcile them or recover them, where they're not judgmental in the sense that we normally think of judgment. The Lord must have been going to have some people in the church that needed that. So we have folks who are calling and saying, help me, help me, help me, help me, help me. Where they're calling saying, help, 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 help. Sometimes it's easy to get frustrated with them because there doesn't seem to be a response to the instruction you're giving them. And so there has got to be some mercy extended. All right? So this is the church, he that showeth mercy with cheerfulness, not regretting the fact he has to do it. He now comes down to verse 9, and he says, let love be without dissimulation. That means don't let your love be fake. I plan on concluding this second book with the ordinary miracle of love. Once I get there, the first one I did time at the end. This one I'm thinking of concluding it with love. And, of course, that will give me the chance to illustrate the work, person and work of Jesus Christ. So love, If 1 John, it says, beloved, let us love one another. Well, what does it mean to love one another? If you're going to love one another, you're going to love one another. And what conditions in this assumption, in this that you get in your paradigm, what is the condition that is essential to you loving this person? Because people are people. I mean, come on, everybody has a personality. Everybody is what they are. And it would be nice if every person, especially people who are in the church, if every person in the church was somehow perfect. If everybody had attained perfection, then that's a snap. That's what we look for when we say talk about going to heaven. We say, boy, we get to heaven, it's going to be perfect. Well, it's not like that when you're on the earth. And so you have to have this love, which is a true love for people. He says to abhor evil and cleave to the good. But then he jumps back again in verse 10 and says, be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another, which means you take the lead in showing the honor. So we, in our love relationship, a part of that love relationship is the lifting of the other person over us, as it were, in showing honor to them. Well, what are you going to honor? What is honorable? What is that person in their faith and in their practice that you would honor? Got to be something. It takes, sometimes you have to look for it. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes it is so noticeable, you can't come into their presence without seeing it or sensing it or feeling it. But he says we are supposed to be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another, taking the lead. So this is this in the paradigm of Christianity, when we start talking about the church, this is the function of the church. The result of that is you're going to have a complete functioning body that has power and can communicate effectively the gospel of Jesus Christ because of that function. So if you begin to subtract out of there, you can see where the church would begin to diminish. And of course, in today's world, the Church of Jesus Christ is basically looked upon as the enemy. The true Church of Jesus Christ, because it is functioning. I'm going to stop there. I don't know how much I'll...